He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin.
This is Car Keys.
Good morning to our listeners for this week's show of Car Keys with Jada Markin, Robin Leach. We are doing this show on the day after the main big weekend, biggest weekend snowstorm to hit our neck of the woods and maybe the country in some time. Some time is anything over 10 years in my book. What it made for me, because I love snowstorms, so listeners, don't worry about it. It won't hang around. Is I like to go driving in snowstorms. And I had some fun yesterday, which was a Sunday for timing. And the roads where I am located, which is in New Canaan, Connecticut for this show, were being cleaned periodically. I would say it seemed the way the snow was falling that at least 3 or 4 hours was going between reclaiming or re-clearing roads that they had cleared just 3 or 4 hours ago before they came back. I fortunately was able to go out in the dark. It was snowing. The roads had not been cleared in a little while, so I got to play in the snow aside from the driveway, which is at my location quite long from the town road and was not plowed after the first plowing several hours before I went out. So the snow was deepest in the driveway and deepest for this particular part of the discussion was at least 10 inches. Now, 10 inches is above ground clearance for many sedan-like cars and in some cases even the smaller SUV cars. And when it's deeper than allowing solid ground clearance other than the weight of the vehicle getting its tires to the ground, it can sometimes become a problem for people who don't know how to deal with it.
So did you ever make it to the road? Did you ever make it to the road?
Yes, I made it down fine. Momentum is one of the key things you want to do if you get your vehicle moving in snow that might be deeper than the ground clearance. The easy ground clearance. It's not just a flat, plain ground clearance situation because the underbelly of a vehicle has a lot of things that are underneath that are not necessarily evenly located at a straight height from front to rear of the vehicle. So you could be dragging underbody components through the snow, which you can see after you've gone along the road and you come back and see your tracks. Sort of like skiing. However, I got down to the town roads, and I would say there were 4 to 6 inches on most of the roads I chose to make my little 20-minute run around to see how it was and have fun. You can drive very nicely in unplowed snow if you know what you're doing. I personally, in a storm like we've had this last weekend, like the snow, unaffected by the pre-treating of the roads that the states and the towns were doing before the storm started. This is why I like this. It's very simple. When you pre-treat a road so that the snow that's and the snow that's falling on it and accumulating hits the pre-treated roads, there's a chemical reaction between the treatment and the snow, which turns it, which melts it, and therefore turns the underbody of the snow falling into a relatively slick and slippery substance. And that can be more dangerous to deal with if you go into a slide or get into trouble because you're going too fast or even braking with anti-lock brakes than it could be if you were just driving through virgin snow with no chemical effect at the bottom of its of the snow piling up. That being said, all the roads around that there were town and state were treated in many cases before the snow. So this chemical effect was readily apparent underneath the snow that I was driving in on my little 20-minute experiment. But what I also had problems with was visibility because it was snowing quite hard during my adventurous drive. The dry snow that was falling does not accumulate on your windshield once you're moving. It just blows over. I do not recommend using a defroster if the snow is not sticking to the windshield, because if you use a defroster and you melt the snow, it freezes. It can freeze on the windshield, and even though you have windshield wipers going, you may not be able to use your washers, which you probably don't want to do, because you would rather have the snow blow over the windshield so you can see. But with snow falling and high beams on, you can have a pretty blinding view of the road ahead. Fortunately, nobody else was on the roads that I was on, and very fortunately, I did not meet a snowplow coming at me, because they were essentially clearing the side roads, and these are town roads, straight down the middle. They were not trying to do one lane, the driving lane that they were going, direction that they were going in, because the snow was so deep. The best thing to do was to make a more or less single lane of drivable conditions on these roads before they would come back and redo them later on. And once the storm comes, they come and do both lanes and push the snow to the sides. If you only have one cleared lane to be able to drive in, you do not want to necessarily have to be pulling over into the unplowed portion of that, because that could pull you even further off the road and possibly get you stuck if you were to have to brake and come to a halt and possibly get yourself pancaked on top of deep snow. In any event, I had an uneventful adventure. I love going out in the snow, and that is my story, and I stick with it. I don't recommend that most listeners probably, or maybe most listeners know how to drive in snow to our show, but it's not something that I would recommend going out, especially when the state directive and maybe the town directives are to keep your cars off the road during this storm, which was very severe by anything memorable in recent memory in our area. Jay, you have any comments?
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you had gotten the memo from DOT not to get on the roads if you didn't have to, but I guess
The memo to DOT was, yes, that was a memo that was out. That was directed more to commercial tractor trailers. And if anybody's been watching the recent news stories of the massive piles up on the interstates all around our country, wherever there was a snowstorm, it was the wisest memo that any DOT operation could recommend, and I guess it was probably followed. That doesn't apply to the commercial pickup truck snowplow or tire people, or if it does, they're not going to get arrested if they're found out there, because they have to do driveways, and they had to maintain driveways at the same time pattern as the towns needed to maintain to keep the roadways open, because the driveway that I'm currently located at has not been plowed since the storm, and it has got an easy 8 to 10 inches of not only the powder snow that fell earlier, but we ended up with a little bit of a sleet-like finish to the storm. It must have been warm up on top, starting out as rain, and by the time it came down on the ground, you could hear it falling, and it compacted the snow so that maybe the 10 inches was reduced to 8. But that snow is much more dense and much more problematical for even getting out of a driveway parking area that you might be in than just the fluffy snow that was occurring much of the time before the ending part.
So in the meantime, I was watching YouTube videos and it just so happened that this week was the Rally of Monte Carlo. It's road racing, European style. I didn't watch much of it, but I saw bits and pieces. And it takes place in the Alps at this time of year in January. And often
Switzerland, the Swiss Alps?
Well, French, Swiss.
Monte Carlo, French Alps, right.
Yeah. Anyway, so, you know, snowy, snowy roads. But what was actually mind-blowing to me is that the road conditions were very, very tough, and these guys are obviously racing and on open roads. And I saw a few clips of cars going off the road and into ditches and falling, in one case, like, you know, almost 10, 15 feet down an embankment. And either, you know, people, spectators who are all along the race course, you know, just run down, pick up the car, push it up, and the car gets back on the road and starts racing. And my thought was just simply this, is how much stronger cars have become over the last 20, 30, 40 years. I mean, these are cars that are falling, you know, upside down, rolling over, and they can sustain their weight and a few times over their weight on being on their roof.
Do they have special reinforcement, Jay, to their structure, basically?
Sure, they do. They always have had, structural reinforcement and roll bars. But still, overall, cars are just so much stronger than they were. The windshields don't even break. They fall, you know, granted there's snow on the ground, but they're falling 10, 15 feet down in a ditch, and the windshield is not even broken. The car's upside down.
That's extraordinarily. Extraordinary. Yeah.
And we're just so lucky to be driving cars that are, again, so much safer than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Good.
And that's my only comment. So moving on, as far as
Move on to your list of best-selling cars of 25.
Best-selling cars of 25. Well, remember when the every year Ford and Toyota were in this, and Honda were in this three-way battle to have the best-selling car, and it always hovered in the 400,000 to 500,000 units.
Yeah, I remember
that. And it was the Honda Accord, the Toyota Camry, and the Ford Taurus. Nobody remembers what a Ford Taurus is, but the Camry and the Honda Accord, the Toyota Camry and the Honda Accord are still alive and kicking and still selling, not in the numbers that they used to, but they're still selling. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I think it was like in the 300,000 unit range.
Well, was it? Because your list is currently starting from the 25 going down. I haven't gotten to the Camry and or the Hondas. Is between 100,000 and 200,000 units for a surprising number of the 25 best-selling vehicles, which tells you how spread out the sales have become, which you may want to comment further on. But you're right. A decade ago or maybe longer, they were in the $300,000 to $500,000 vehicle range, competing only with, said, the Camry and the Accord were.
And then now I'm looking at the list, and the Honda Civic and the Toyota Corolla, which are smaller sedans, right? But like you've always mentioned, you know, the size of these cars just keeps growing. Honda Civic 238,000, Toyota Corolla 248,000. So those numbers are pretty steady. Yeah, Toyota Camry 316,000 units sold.
Just for a sedan, to let me interrupt you, that is supposedly extinct from or becoming extinct as a desirable model to buy by the users of cars, of SUV drivers and the like. And the Camry has been going against this train and caused the Ford Fusion to disappear, has caused the Chevy, what was the Chevy model, Jay, that just recently disappeared from the production line, leaving the Hyundai Sonata, the equivalent.
The Malibu?
The Malibu, right. The Kia equivalent to the Hyundai, and something like, I think there's a Honda sedan that matches up to the Camry size. Is there not above the Accord? I can't remember what it is, but.
No, the Accord is the
biggest Camry. One.
Yeah.
Okay, but anyway, so, they're still out there selling. People still want sedans, apparently.
Yes.
Enough to keep those models on the road.
So the best-selling vehicles, and for once, Car and Driver has now combined, or they have been maybe for the last couple of years, they do combine cars, SUVs, and trucks, as opposed to having separate lists. The big hitters in the passenger vehicles, let's call it this way, so cars and SUVs, you're looking at the CRV Honda, 400,000 units, and the Toyota RAV4, 479,000 units. So those are the two best-selling passenger vehicles in the country. And the Toyota RAV4, I think, is the best-selling vehicle in the world right now, and it just passed the Tesla Y. Of course, here in the U.S., pickup trucks are still the best-selling vehicles. And truth be told, you know, they are used for personal purposes as far as well as work vehicles. So there's I guess there's a reason for that. But yeah, so that's the list. There's a separate list for EVs, and obviously EV sales are way off compared to you know, global sales. The only two vehicles to make it on the 20 top selling vehicles are, I think, the Tesla 3 and the Tesla Y. Every other electric vehicle is way off that mark.
Okay.
Speaking of EVs, and I know we get back to that, and you and I both talk about things we don't know much about because neither one of us drives one. But a couple of things. Volvo is coming out with a pretty cool SUV, and we talked about it briefly, the EX60. But it's not going to be cheap. We're talking $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 for a pretty cool vehicle with decent range, anywhere between 300 and 400 miles range. But what I'm really following is that, and I just read an article about that. It makes a lot of sense. Look for used EVs, electric vehicles, to be quite affordable in 2026. And
used, you said, yeah.
Used, three-year-old vehicles. And the reason for that, in the article was mentioning this, is a lot of these electric vehicles, two, three, 4 years ago, were leased, and all those leases are coming up, and so all these
flooding the used car market.
Correct, and so now you're looking at three-year-old 2023 cars that are getting on the market, whether it be Tesla, Mercedes, you know, even Lucid, the first Lucids, and there are, you know, the hunch is that there are going to be deals to be made, and you can see it already. It's just, and I think that's the way to go. You know, if you're not going to get any tax credits, because there's no more tax credits on EVs, you know, go for a used EV.
And absolutely, I know right. I agree. Jay, along this side, this one of the things that people should understand, and you know more about it than anybody, than either of the two of us, as far as the longevity factor of batteries in electric cars. Going back several years when you were telling me some Tesla batteries were going into 200,000 miles without needing replacement, I think you said. But I would not be too disturbed by buying a used, a three-year-old electric vehicle based on a concern possibly of the battery life situation. Because I think battery lives in electric cars, for the most part, are pretty greatly more reliable than the warranty that they seem to come with suggests. Yes. They might only be.
Yes.
I can say that my 2013 Camry Hybrid came with a warranty for the battery, for the hybrid battery part of it, as a lifetime. There has been no problem with the battery, and it's now got 140,000 miles on it and climbing. And it's now, 11 years old or 12 years old. So that in itself tells you, in the Sonata, the hybrid I have, that battery for the hybrid system, which is not the same as a full electric battery system, is going strong without needing replacement.
Yeah,
I wouldn't worry about the battery situation unless you get a car with a bad battery pack, which you're never going to be able to know in advance, anyways.
No, I wouldn't worry about it at all.
Okay,
so. Something else, in all of this political turmoil that we are living in, Canada has just announced that they were dropping tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles from 100% to 6%. Effective, I'm not quite sure if it's immediately, but it's a pretty sure thing. And that is going to change the landscape.
If it expands beyond Canada.
Yes. And you know, obviously it means that, you know, we are going to see electric vehicles, Chinese electric vehicles in China. It's going to take a while, but not that long for Chinese dealerships to pop up around the country. But I think we're going to see them, and I think they and we're going to see smaller EVs. And that's a trend we're seeing in Europe too. Renault is doing very well with their Renault 5 and their new Twingo coming out. And I still believe that small electric vehicles, going around town vehicles, is really the smartest use of an electric vehicle. And unfortunately, and I'm going from, I know I'm going from.
Yeah, I know where you're going. Chevrolet Bolt.
Exactly. Chevrolet Bolt.
They just redesigned it. It's better than ever. And they allegedly are discontinuing it after this model year or 2017,
yes.
Jay?
2027.
A one-year resurgence, listeners. If you're a potential Bolt buyer, you had better go out and place an order at your nearest Chevrolet dealer, because it may become extinct for not a very good reason, in my opinion.
Exactly. And the reason is the I forget which car, but some
they're going to put a gasoline fossil fuel vehicle in its place in the assembly line, and they can't seem to make. I would think they would figure out how they could have both assembly lines running, because I think the Bolt is a catch for anybody who wants to buy a small electric vehicle runabout.
Yep, totally agree. Yep. We've agreed on that for a long time.
We sure have.
I'm very sad
to read this latest thing that just came across the waves in the last, the radio waves and the TV waves in the last week or so, about GM's stopping production of the Bolt at the end of whatever it is this year or into next.
Yeah. I have a little Q&A for you, Robin.
Okay.
Following an article I just read not too long ago. The features you never use in your car.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm going to throw them at you, and you tell me what you use and don't use.
Okay.
In the order and this. And some of them are features that don't exist in any of your cars, I believe, probably. Okay. But that you've used in other cars. Lane departure intervention.
Lane departure intervention comes in this up a couple of ways. The intervention that is used on several of my cars is, of course, the blind spot or side mirror warnings that go off if you start to change lanes and you can't see anything theoretically outside of the inside car rearview mirror or even the outside side mirror. That is one of the best inventions that they made. I hope it's standard in every car that's currently being produced.
Probably.
Because you can lose a tractor trailer in a blind spot on your vehicle. I don't know how it gets lost, but it can get lost, and the blind spot detection system is a savior.
Yes, but lane departure intervention is when you get the little kick in the steering wheel, either
Correct.
A vibration
Correct.
or the car pulling back into the lane. Well, how do
Correct.
You feel about that?
Well, yes, I do, and because there are a couple of Audi vehicles that are in my ownership now, and the steering wheel does indeed vibrate if you are don't have your hands on it, or even if you have your hands on it. After one or two successful lane departure avoidance signals going forward, that is probably a good feature. And beyond that, I don't have any vehicles that might have even a more advanced system, if you know of it.
Head-up displays. What do you think is head-up?
I don't have them, and I must say I have driven a few rental cars with them. I find them interesting in the dark, more interesting in the dark to see than I think I care about seeing them in the daytime. For listeners who don't know that, they actually display the speed you're going at. They may display a couple of other things now. They've added some features to it. And you don't have to look down at your speedometer to see how fast you're going, because it's displayed in your visual view of the road in a three-dimensional sort of light situation.
So,
I think that's probably okay, but I don't know whether it's annoying or not.
I personally don't like it, and I certainly don't like it. I certainly don't like it in the Range Rover, because Range Rover has it non-aligned in your, it's not straight in front of you. So if you're looking at the road, you're looking through the steering wheel, and your heads-up display is side to your side. I can't remember if it's left or right.
Oh dear. Okay. You're segueing me into the next topic I want to bring in after you finish with your Range Rover complaint, because I think you're.
I'm done
right.
with it. I'm done.
You're done with it. Okay, listeners. Some of the newer cars, the newest cars, what seems to be getting bigger in the dashboard are full dashboard wide touch screen displays of all the things you're supposed to be able to control in your car. I know I am very critical of the redesign of the Audi Q5 vehicle from 24 to 25. And apparently whether it's going to continue in 26, I don't know. But I recently was able to have a Q5 for a weekend. And it's got a long screen. I think it's 18 inches wide. From in front of the driver across the console, and everything that you're supposed to do to control your car is on that screen. And if that's not a distraction to be gotten rid of, I don't know what the engineers think the benefits of it are.
Okay,
I want to just add one more thing. A real estate friend of mine he's had 5 Q5s, and he just leased a 25 Q5, and he absolutely hates it for exactly the same reason I have just said to the listeners on this show. He says he wish he hadn't gotten it, but he didn't know it in the test drive. So if you're going to go out and get a car with a large touchscreen and do a test drive, besides turning out of a dealership and going 4 rights to get back to the dealership in probably 10 minutes or less, which doesn't give you a chance to look at all this technology that's in there, you should be paying attention to the convenience aspect of a touchscreen or not.
Okay, and Robin, enough of the rant. If you can't see a 24-inch wide screen the first time you go in a car, there's something, you got a bigger problem than that. And
yes,
by the way,
you don't go to turn the radio on. You don't go to turn the heated seats on. You don't go to do all sorts of things, all of which had controls on a dash that you could tactilely touch.
So,
push the button.
Okay, enough with the rant. Back to the Volvo EX60. Yeah. You will have voice activated controls for all of that. And furthermore, your interactions, your voice activation will be controlled by Google AI, so that, you know, even if you're not quite sure what you want, Google AI will know better than you what you need or want. No, this is serious. And
I agree. I now know. And maybe the younger people, if they can afford these cars with all this technology, and that's another question, will love it. But I can suggest to you that users or owners, you may be an exception, Jen, you can say so, on our age group, are not going to be as appealing of these technologies. I know voice control is there. It's there on the Audis. It's there on my Jeeps. I can, if I remember how to do it, I can actually, yes, tune my radio with my voice in my Jeep Cherokees. And if it will respond, because if it understands the way I want to do it versus the way the engineers put it into the system, it is fine. And I can go from FM to Sirius XM to AM and the station number, if I know the station number. But the other thing about that is, when you rent a car in, let's say, Las Vegas, you don't know what the station numbers are, so you can't do anything. So is the old radio that you can have a dial on it better, so you can scroll through the screen on the radio as opposed to trying to, how do you voice control finding a radio station in Las Vegas?
I haven't been to Vegas in 25 years.
Well, okay, Beverly Hills, Miami, whatever. This is what's going on with the technology, listeners. So, yeah, we chuckle, and you may like it, and if so, so be it. You can listen to your hosts on this station squabble about whether it's good or bad or in between. I'd like to return to your 25 best-selling cars that Motor Trend did last year in another show, Jay. So until next time, listeners, enjoy the snow. Drive safely if the roads are not perfectly dry and clear. And we will see you on another show of Car Keys with Jay DeMarkin and Robin Leach.
Car Keys with Robin Leach and Jay DeMarkin is produced at the facilities of WHDD 91.9 FM, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.